Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. When you touch a hot stove, you quickly learn that it burns and you shouldn't do that again. Researchers at the Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Machine Learning are applying that very same principle to technology that enables computers to learn from experience. As Dr. Russ Greiner explains, that technology will allow us to use computers to make predictions. And computer scientists Dr. Paul Liu and Dwayne Savron are using machine learning to reduce the amount of time biologists need to characterize newly discovered proteins. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Machine Learning was launched in 2002. Over the last 5 years, researchers with the centre have developed several groundbreaking programs in a field that leaves most people's heads just spinning. Yet their work has applications in everything from banking to game playing to medicine. These machine learning scientists deal in data, all those bits and bytes of information we call knowledge and experience. Through computer programming, they're developing new technology for computers to do what our brains do, learn, anticipate, and predict. Dr. Russ Greiner is a professor of computing science at the University of Alberta, and he's the director of the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning.
I've always been fascinated by systems that work, and getting systems to work on new problems is something that's been exciting. And machine learning gives a way to, given a problem, given the data sample for the problem, find a way to get answers to it.
Now, when you say machine learning, like, what is machine learning? How would you define that?
Well, I use the vision statement for our center. Machine learning is helping the world understand data and make informed decisions. So someone may have large databases that describe, for example, medical records, and we want to use it to make decisions about a new patient who comes in to decide what treatment will work effectively or what treatment shouldn't be applied in this case. So we're taking the knowledge in this database and using it to make decisions about individual patients.
But where does the learning come in?
Got another great question. Learning is basically finding patterns in the data. It may sound a little subtle. It's trying to find patterns that say, if a patient has this symptom and that symptom, but not this other one, then this treatment makes sense. Or again, other examples, you're playing chess and it's finding some configuration on the board that says, at this point, moving a bishop makes a lot of sense. And moving a bishop, the square is what's going to be effective. So it's finding the patterns that say, under certain conditions, I should take some action. I should make this informed decision, given this context.
So then how does that compare to human learning?
Well, clearly people also are learning. We take other experiences that we've encountered and use those experiences to do better the next time we have a similar situation. Now, of course, people don't have silicon in our brain. We have another whole mechanism to make it work. The details of the algorithms may be very different, but the underlying idea of having experience in the world, seeing data, finding massive amounts of data, and using that to say, this is the nugget, this is the underlying idea, and then using that later on. That's what people do very effectively in animals, and again, there's a lot of interactions amongst, there's a lot of different disciplines that are all looking at how can you take a database, how can you take a set of experiences, and use that to find some inner essence of what's going on, and then apply that later on. So people learn also, probably very different algorithms from our brains to the computers, but the same ideas, using experiences to solve problems later on.
Now, you've mentioned algorithms. So what are algorithms and how do they fit into all of this machine learning stuff?
So let me take the simplest example of a learning context. We're trying to build a classifier. So what's a classifier? That's perhaps a doctor, or something taking the role of a doctor. I describe a patient in terms of several factors, several symptoms, his age, gender, various histological tests, various other information about the patient. And I want to use that, I want to take the information and produce an answer. Yes, give him the drug, or no, you shouldn't give it to them. That's what a classifier does. There's no learning in this. The challenge is, how do you produce this classifier? How do you produce something that takes a description of a patient and goes from that to giving a prediction you should give them this treatment, and hopefully that'll be effective. The learning algorithm takes a set of previous data, historical records of other patients, and for every patient, I note the same description of age and gender and histological reports. For these historical patients, I also know the outcome. This patient did get better. And you know, this over 25-year-old female smoker with this particular treatment got better, whereas another patient who's female but under 25, who's a non-smoker, with this treatment did not get better. I have a whole list of this information. I take that, and what the machine learning algorithm does is it takes this, analyzes this data, and comes up with the classifier. So now a new patient comes in, I can look at this new patient and say, this patient looks like another patient, another cluster of patients, and therefore what worked for them is probably going to work for this patient, so I should give them the treatment.
Now, you're director of the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning, and you're working in all kinds of different areas. You've mentioned, as examples, some of the medical areas, but where all does machine learning touch?
Anyone who has data and wants to understand it can be and should be using machine learning. Whether it's, you know, I've been looking at medical records or SNP, single nucleotide polymorphism data, or data from microarrays from looking at gene expressions. But you also could look at games that people have played, historical reports of trajectory of the sequence of moves people have played in chess, or the hands people have been dealt and how they responded to hands in poker. Or you can look at robots that look at the world around them and make decisions about what actions to take there. These are examples of projects that our center's been looking at. There are many others as well. You can look at credit reports and try to decide who is going to default on a loan. Another good example of machine learning is spam detections. That would be a case where you want to build a tool that looks at email messages and decides what's spam as opposed to something that should let through. All these are examples of applications to which machine learning has been applied effectively and successfully.
What's the future for this technology for machine learning?
Open-ended. As I mentioned earlier, you got data, you want to understand it, we can help. Let me also maybe make a contrast here. If you want to build a classifier, going back to my simple example earlier, one obvious approach is you just program it. You just program something that says, if X and Y, you know, if over 25 and a smoker, then give this treatment. Otherwise, if under 25 and female, then do this. And in many cases, you can program it. If you can, you might as well do it. But there are some caveats. One caveat is, what if no one knows the answer? You know, who's going to get AIDS? Or what treatment is going to work for AIDS? No, it's not that the doctors know that it's not telling us. No one knows the answer. But we have voluminous data. We can look at this gigabytes of data and try to figure out the patterns in that that determine who's going to respond effectively. That's one example of where machine learning is essential because no one knows the answer. There are other places as well. Driving a car. We all drive cars. And it's not that we don't know how to do it, but it's hard to describe how to do it. If I were to describe a scene in front of me in terms of the pixels that correspond to the intensities at every location and say, given this visual input, do I turn left or I slam my brakes on? Well, it's hard to describe that. But there are programs that have learned to do this. I didn't mention the most prevalent example, the recent DARPA challenge, where there was a challenge that we did not participate in, but some colleagues at Stanford and Carnegie Mellon and other places did, of driving a car through a desert autonomously and get there within 10 hours. And there's a team of people that built algorithms that learn to see the scene in front of them and decide, is this going to go straight or turn right? Does this mean slam on the brakes or slow down? So again, that's a good example where a person could have done it, but the goal was doing it autonomously.
So there was nobody actually driving the car.
That is correct. Again, we didn't participate in it, but we're very aware of the technologies these people used, and it's pretty exciting that they were able to succeed at it. $2 million prize for that. Another example is when the world changes under you. So you're controlling a factory. You have a system that controls a plant. You might have a very good controller for one day, but the plant changes as equipment wears out. you could stop and reprogram it after every few months, but it's more effective and more efficient to just monitor what's happening and to learn from that how to handle it more effectively. So over time, watch as it evolves. A fourth example is where there are many different situations, where there are different people, for example, who have different ways they use software. What works well for me may not work well for you. A spam filter that gets rid of all the things I consider spam may get rid of things that you didn't want to block for whatever your reasons. Can we personalize it? Well, again, I could write a program. I could hand you a program for me and one for you and one for every other person who uses the software. It'd be better to build an adaptive system that just watches what I do, learns what things I put in my spam blocked mail, and use that, find the patterns in that that says what type of mail I don't want to receive and learn from that and adapt to me over time. That'd be a fourth example of situations where machine learning is critical.
Russ, what would you consider some of the recent successes that the Machine Learning Center has had?
There have been a lot of exciting things happening. The poker competition where it was a man versus machine. We didn't win that. The computer didn't win it, but it was very exciting. And the poker players, the professionals who participated in that, said this was the most fun and the most energy they've expended in a long, long time. So that was a tremendous coup for us to have been that well. And, of course, our team also won two of the three poker competitions, computer-computer competitions. That was great. The game of Go was thought to be something computers could never do, at least not in my lifetime. They just beat a professional Go player for the first time. And again, I hope you cover that as a story in the near future as well. But it's very exciting. An article in Scientific American about this Go program.
What other successes do you have here?
Well, again, there's some very interesting theoretical results. New ways to do experimental design, where you actually, given a fixed budget, decide what tests to run to get the data to build the classifier. That's pretty exciting. There's stuff on action-respecting embedding. There's stuff on support vector machines. But other ones are very practical systems. I talked before about the WebIC system for an all worldwide web recommendation system. We've also spoken about the brain tumor project, which again is ongoing and very exciting with new results here as well. Another project I'm very excited by is the Proteome Analyst project. This is one-stop shopping for information about proteins. You give a protein, it answers questions like where does this protein live in the cell and what function does it have. To the best of our knowledge, it's the world's most accurate predictor of subcell localization. This project is another example of something that would not happen without machine learning to build predictors for subcell localization, for general functions and other facilities.
Well, it looks like people are also taking notice of what's coming out of this center and the work that you and your colleagues are doing. And you've received an Aztec Award for the work in Alberta. And also, you've just been awarded a Killam Fellowship. What will you be doing with your Killam Fellowship?
I'll keep doing the fun things I'm doing now. a little bit richer, but I'm very honored to have been awarded this. I was also honored by the umbrella organization, the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, which made me a fellow of their institute this year. So I'm the third member of our center, three of the eight PIs who have been awarded this fellow of this organization. So again, it shows that we're doing exciting, interesting work that people are aware of, and we're gaining, our center's getting credit for doing the exciting work that we're doing.
Congratulations, Russ, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Russ Greiner, a professor of computing science at the University of Alberta and director of the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning. Just as the genome refers to all the genes in an organism, the proteome encompasses all the proteins in an organism. And there are already hundreds of thousands of proteins that biologists are aware of, with more just waiting to be discovered. That's where a new web-based program called the Proteome Analyst comes in. It uses machine learning technology, and it's one of the success stories from the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning. Two of the key researchers involved in the development of the Proteome Analyst are computer scientist Dr. Dwayne Zaffron and Dr. Paul Liu from the University of Alberta. I first asked Dwayne where the idea for the program originated.
Okay, it goes back a few years. There were two biologists and two computing scientists sitting around, Brian Sykes and David Wishart, who were the biologists, and Jonathan Schaefer and I, who were the computing scientists. And we said, gee, there's got to be a better way to look at molecular biology than just going into the laboratory and doing experiments. Specifically, David and Brian were working in something called the Protein Engineering Network of Center of Excellence, and they were interested in trying to bring some computer scientists on board to analyze proteins. And at the time, biologists were spending most of their life analyzing one or two proteins, trying to figure out a few of the things that they did. And these guys said, well, we in the lab, we use some computers to try to predict what these proteins are. So we compare a protein to a database of existing proteins, find the similar ones, and then we say, well, maybe my protein does what the similar one does, and then they go to the lab and they do an experiment. Problem was, with the Human Genome Project, there were a lot of proteins being thrown into the database that people knew what they did, and so it was hard to compare this single protein against them all. And also, there were, instead of one protein of interest, there were thousands of proteins of interest, as sequencing machines made it really easy to sequence a whole bunch of proteins at once. So instead of comparing one protein to a few, they wanted to compare many proteins to many proteins, and they thought a couple of computing scientists might be able to help them out. So the Proteome Analyst Project was born. David was an active collaborator. Paul Liu, another computing scientist, and myself came on board. Jonathan started but had to leave the project because he had other pressing matters. And so the project at the beginning was to take a whole bunch of proteins that we knew nothing about and try to make predictions based on thousands of proteins that we know something about.
Well, if a scientist, a biologist, could spend his whole career just looking at one or two, how on earth could you, as a non-biologist, even know where to start to develop a computer software program?
Well, the short answer is listen to David. We spent a lot of time talking to the biologists, finding out what was important about these proteins, and then we just started to discover, to bring in algorithms that already existed, but to package them up together in one place so we could have one-stop shopping. So there are algorithms, that is, you know, computational things that you can do to compare proteins. And what we discovered very rapidly was that a lot of the techniques that we were using to compare proteins to other proteins could benefit from something called machine learning, where our programs would learn based on a bunch of data about what a bunch of proteins do, what a new protein might do by extracting some characteristics from the new protein, some features from the new protein, comparing it to the features of the proteins that we already had and what they did. So that area is called machine learning, and very quickly we decided that we needed some help, so Russ Greiner came aboard as an expert in machine learning because that's what he did. So it's a combination of techniques. It's knowing something about making software systems like web-based programs, getting a bunch of machines to do computations so that you can do the computations fast, studying algorithms that existed in computing science, and bringing in this machine learning component to kind of mix the whole thing together. The key here is that it's faster to do something on computer than it is to do an experiment. All the computer does is make predictions. It doesn't say that this protein does X. But if you have 1,000 proteins and there's 100 different things that they can do, and you say, this is what we think these 1,000 can do, it's easier for the lab biologist then to validate what your prediction is than to just start from scratch and just trying all the different experiments. So I want to be clear that we don't actually determine what proteins do. We make predictions about what they do.
And do you then update it as they discover more about what the proteins actually do?
That's a great question. So there are these databases, and the database that we use a lot is called the SwissProt database. When we started this project, I believe the SwissProt database had slightly less than 100,000 proteins in. So when we get a new protein, the protein we compare this to were 100,000 proteins that biologists had characterized. Every month, there's a new version of SwissProt. So every month, we rerun all of our predictions based on the latest versions of the proteins that are already there. And today, SwissProt has, I think, in the neighborhood of 300,000 proteins that we're currently using. So the answer is yes, we rerun our predictions constantly based on new information as we get the new information. Because it's all automated, we can do that.
Paul, when you first started working on this, what were some of the challenges that you faced and that you had to overcome?
Well, one of them is that we were, for myself and for us in general, we were working in a relatively new area of research in terms of the biology and working with biologists. So we all had, including myself, a learning curve in working with the biology aspect of it. The challenges that for me personally was coming to the project, I wanted to apply my expertise in and interest in areas such as high-performance computing. How can we use a lot of different computers to deal with just the vast amounts of data, for example? And I also had an interest in user interface design. How do we make the complicated aspects of all these tools and the information presented, and how to make that useful and understandable by biologists? So these were some of the things that we faced at the beginning.
And how did you overcome that?
A lot of trial and error, certainly. In fact, a big part of what the project has entailed has been trying out ideas, getting feedback from biologists and getting feedback from other people, and going back and rethinking them. An idea might sound good at the beginning, but it requires a lot of refinement and iteration. And then we try another generation of it, and we just keep refining over time.
Now, you actually have a product now that's up on the website, and people are using it. Who's using it, and why are they using it? How are they using it?
We've had a diverse group of people from all around the world using it. And basically, I think they hear about our system in terms of what it does well. For example, we have the best subcellular localization predictor, which is a prediction of where in the cell a particular protein performs its main function. And a lot of times people are interested in proteins that act in specific organelles. And so when they read about how well we do on these predictions, then they come to our website to filter out the short list, for example, of proteins that might operate in a certain organelle. We also do reasonably well with things like predicting which proteins are involved in different pathways or in the cell. So these are sequences of reactions that convert certain biological molecules from one to the other or have similar types of functions. And so they come to our site to try to better understand the proteins in the pathways that they're interested in.
Dwayne, just looking at the way that people are now using this program, the Proteome Analyst, what kinds of things are they looking for?
Well, Proteome Analyst is kind of like a collection of baseball cards. It's a way to construct baseball cards for you. Now, it's not really baseball, but let me use that as an analogy. If a biologist is interested in a protein or a set of proteins, they want to know various aspects of it. And one of the things they want to know, Paul alluded to, is where in the cell it does its work. The other thing they may want to know is what is its function? Does it break other proteins down? Does it transport other proteins? Is it involved as a catalyst of a particular chemical reaction in the cell? So there are a lot of different things. And what Proteome Analyst does is it fills in fields for all of these. It makes predictions for all of these. So we don't really know the exact purpose that people put our software to, but anybody who needs to know where a protein exists in the cell or what it does in the cell would use our software to make a prediction. After they make that prediction, they may verify it in the lab. They may be using it in the interests of trying to then figure out what proteins can block the function of this protein for, say, drug discovery. We don't really require them to tell us what they're using it for, but at the lowest level, they're really using it to make predictions about those fundamental things, where in the cell a protein works, and what that protein actually does in the cell.
What competition do you have?
Competition is maybe too harsh of a word, but there is another protein subcellular localization program that, for example, that's running at Simon Fraser University. I mention it because it is one of outstanding quality. It's specifically targeted to a subgroup of proteins that are from bacteria. So our Proteome Analyst will predict subcellular localization for bacteria, but also for animals, including the human, for plants, for fungi. So there are different groups of proteins. The Fiona Brinkman's lab at Simon Fraser University has something called P-Sort B that makes predictions on bacteria, and it's very good. And so I kind of regard them as the friendly competition, the people that we need to make sure that we stay ahead of in the bacterial domain, although we are collaborating, so they're not really competition in the sense that we exchange data all the time and techniques and that sort of thing.
Paul, what's next for Proteome Analyst?
While there are many avenues by which we're seeking to improve protium analysts, the explanation facility is a constant project to try to present very complicated ideas in a meaningful way. We're always trying to improve the accuracy of our system. And, for example, lately we've had graduate students working on using what's called natural language processing. So not just trying to extract information out of what's known as the SwissProt database, but to look at publications in these databases, through abstracts describing the studies of different proteins, and looking into natural language, the English that's written there, and using that as the basis for trying to make predictions about proteins. All sorts of other techniques try to improve the accuracy, not relying on either the abstracts or the protein databases, but just looking at the properties of the proteins themselves, so-called local information on them. And we're branching out into different metabolic pathway predictions and related projects to that. So there are many, many things that are being worked on.
What's the web address?
The web address is www.cs.ualberta.ca/bioinfo/PA.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Duane.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Duane Zaffron, a professor of computing science at the University of Alberta. I also spoke with Dr. Paul Liu, an associate professor in the same department. Their work on Proteome Analyst is supported in part by the Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Machine Learning. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Ingenuity, I-Corps, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Alberta Conservation Association, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the University of Lethbridge, Genome Alberta, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Research Council, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.